Rosaline Deutsch is an art historian and critic who teaches modern and contemporary art at Barnard College and Columbia University in New York City. She earned her PhD from the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. She has written extensively and lectured internationally on such interdisciplinary topics as art and urbanism, art and the public sphere, feminist theories of subjectivity and visual representation, and contemporary art and war. Her essays have appeared in Grey Room, October, Art Forum, Art in America, and Society and Space, among other journals, in many exhibition catalogs also, and ontologies, and in numerous translations. In May 2009, she delivered the Wellick Library Lectures at the Critical Theory Institute, University of California, Irvine. Rosaline Deutsch is the author of Evictions, Art and Spatial Politics, MIT Press, 1996, and Hiroshima After Iraq, Three Studies in War and Art and War, Columbia University Press, 2010. And so Rosaline Deutsch's talk this afternoon is entitled On War, an Aesthetic Project. So please, welcome.
Sorry, I'm not used to a Mac, so I'm asking her to do this. That's the best image. It's live.
So, okay. How do I advance? I think that. Yes, yes.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you, Christine. Really happy to be here. My talk is called Unwar, an Aesthetic Project. The project of abolishing war, not a particular war, but war as a social institution, is often ridiculed as well-intentioned but naively idealistic. War is inevitable, we hear. Humans are predatory animals, and besides, there has always been war. Who can forget the opening of Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five, in which the narrator tells a friend that he's writing an anti-war novel, and the friend replies, "You know what I say to people when I hear they're writing anti-war books? I say, why don't you write an anti-glacier book instead?" What he meant, of course, the narrator explains, was that there would always be wars, that they were as easy to stop as glaciers. I believe that too. Of course, that was before global warming. Still, Krzysztof Wodyczko has fearlessly undertaken the project of bringing about what Immanuel Kant called perpetual peace in an ongoing project, in an ongoing art and architectural work titled The Arc de Triomphe, World Institute for the Abolition of War, and in a book, The Abolition of War, which documents, contextualizes, and theorizes the work. The Arc de Triomphe, World Institute for the Abolition of War, one of the artists' group of recent works devoted to the topic of war, is a proposal to attach a scaffold-like, transparent structure to the monumental Arc de Triomphe in Paris. Monumental buildings and sculptures embody what Friedrich Nietzsche called monumental history, and Walter Benjamin renamed the history of the victors, and therefore all monuments, whether or not they overtly commemorate war, can be considered war memorials. Indeed, Wodyczko has treated them as such in public projections that animate and destabilize monumental structures. However, the neoclassical Arc de Triomphe, the object of Vodichko's new project, is not only an overt war memorial, but an especially hyperbolic example of the genre. Commissioned in 1806 and completed in 1836, modeled on the Roman Arch of Titus, it was, until 1982, the largest triumphal arch in the world, setting, quote, the tone for public monuments with triumphant patriotic messages. As the linchpin of the city's sequence of monuments and grand thoroughfares known as the historical axis, the Arc occupies a central place in both Paris and the European Union. It glorifies Napoleonic conquests and served for many years as the rallying point of French troops parading after successful military campaigns. Beneath the Arc lies the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier from World War I. Sorry, these are a little out of order, obviously. Beneath the Arc lies the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier from World War I, the war to end all wars. Installed on Armistice Day in 1920 and accompanied by the first eternal flame lit in Europe since the 4th century, as well as an inscription reading, "Here lies a French soldier who died for the fatherland," 1914 to 1918. The monument is adorned with 30 shields inscribed with the name of 96 revolutionary and Napoleonic military victories, allegorical and historical friezes, engraved lists of French victories, engraved lists of 660 soldiers and generals who fought in French victories, and 4 enormous sculptural reliefs, including, most famously, François Rude's Bellicose La Marseillaise, which features a wild-eyed, winged victory wearing a helmet crowned by furies. The chronological order of the reliefs, which progress from departure to triumph to resistance to peace, suggests that war can produce peace. Vodichko approaches the Arc de Triomphe as not so much a symbol, but rather a symptom of what he and others refer to as our culture of war, a culture that helps to orchestrate war as collective madness. The motivation to fight and die in war, writes Vodichko, is perpetuated by a culture of war that manifests itself through uniforms, war games, parades, military decorations, and war memorials, the creation of war art and military art, martial music and war museums, and the popular fascination with weapons, war toys, violent video and computer games, battle reenactments, collectibles, and military history and literature. Enclosed within Vodichko's new structure, the Arc de Triomphe remains visible, but appears, I want to put on a different image. Enclosed within Vodichko's new structure, the Arc de Triomphe remains visible, but appears isolated and entrapped, transformed into a gigantic specimen, even a pathogen. The World Institute combines commemorative, research, educational, and proactive functions. It permits scholars and the public to examine the Arc and also houses a wide array of activities devoted to peacemaking, a process that Vodichko calls unwar, a term he prefers to peace. Peace, after all, can coexist with preparedness for war, whereas unwar implies disarmament, a process of undoing war, which, as we shall see, the artist understands as an individual and collective state of mind. Vidichko's design for an architectural and institutional project to disarm the Ark and the larger culture of war exhibits the same combination of practicality and vision that distinguishes his earlier works of interrogative design, such as The Homeless Vehicle of 1988. Like the interrogative design projects, the World Institute incorporates precise technical designs meant for actual use into a vivid, imaginative anticipation of a social condition that may come to be. A system of ramps, elevators, horizontally moving walkways, and vertically moving viewing platforms intersect along the outside and through the inside of the Ark, allowing visitors to study the Ark's iconography and diagnose the pathologies that the culture of war tries to repress. And I'm just going to show you a few renderings of the system, some seen from the inside of the Ark and others from the outside. That's obviously from the outside. For instance, when standing on a platform to view at eye level the female representation of victory at the top of Rude's La Marseillaise, one can detect just how crazed she is. External and internal plasma screens and pixel boards installed throughout the scaffolding display programs related to the Institute's work and encourage viewers to stop to join discussions. Parallel to the main frieze of the Ark is a continuous strip of media display panels enumerating all recorded wars, campaigns, battles, and military assaults on civilians, and listing direct and indirect human casualties. Similarly, parallel to each relief honoring a Napoleonic battle, stands a list of killed and wounded soldiers, prisoners of war, and civilians. The plan of Vidichko's project, first introduced in Harvard Design Magazine in 2010, exists in different versions. And at this point, the World Institute's program is also provisional. In his book, the artist describes a division of the top floors of the structure into four informational zones containing auto-visual, interactive, telepresence, and immersive displays and environments. The zones may be devoted to providing information about past and present peace-building efforts, about the disarmament process, about the present state of world armament, past and present cultural, artistic, and pedagogical projects that have contributed to the abolition of war, and multidisciplinary theoretical discourses in peace-related fields. The program also includes a world situation map, which you see at the back of this rendering, to be located in the area above the roof of the Ark in the central horizontal section of the upper level of the structure, displaying the changing global dynamics of wars, conflicts, post-war, post-conflict, and peace zones. The map is suspended at the center of a large space devoted to a discursive forum for the abolition of war, a highly mediatized space that hosts special events and global conferences. The area around the discursive forum houses facilities for a cross-disciplinary center for global peace projects, a center that would develop and implement practical work aimed at abolishing war. Vidichko's World Institute for the Abolition of War aims to render the war memorial inoperative in promoting war. And yet, the artist says, it's not enough to disarm the culture of war. Unwar projects must also disarm the individual. Indeed, one of the premises of the World Institute is that abolishing war is an individual responsibility. Vidichko's call for individual responsibility arises not from moralism, but from the conviction that we are accountable for war because, as psychoanalysis teaches us, war is hidden in our unconscious minds. We are ourselves inner war memorials, writes Vidichko, echoing Gertrude Stein, who in 1947 observed that while there is certainly war outside, there is also war inside. What is there inside, in one, that makes one know all about war? Stein asked. War, of course, is above all a collective phenomenon. So the notion that we are inner war memorials raises the vexed question of the relationship between war inside and war outside, between, that is, the psychical and the social. Is violence installed in us from within or without? In an essay about this question, about, that is, the location of violence, Jacqueline Rose asks, following Wilhelm Reich, where does the misery come from? She notes two answers that are commonly given to this question. One, offered by Reich, asserts that violence is imposed on the subject's psyche by a strictly external world, which is itself untouched by psychic processes. The other answer asserts that a strictly internal psychical world determines social violence. Rose observes that the two seemingly opposing answers share a warlike structure. Each pits inside and outside against each other in deadly combat, and in doing so, avoids the radical ambiguity of the inside-outside psychical-social relationship. The relationship is ambiguous because, for one thing, the psychoanalytic subject itself is social, which is to say we're formed through relationships and the emergence of the subject is one and the same with the entry into culture. Therefore, there can be no bright line, no rigid polarity between internal and external worlds. In addition, psychoanalysis investigates the connection between individual and social subjectivity, particularly in its study of what has been called the group mind. Psychoanalytically speaking, then, the idea that war exists inside each of us doesn't mean, as strictly sociologically oriented thinkers tend to conclude, that an external culture of war imposes war on our minds, though this is no doubt true. Neither does it mean that the state forces us to make war, though this is also true. Rather, it means that unconscious aggressivity, a tendency toward destructive, hostile attitudes and behaviors, structures our emergence as human subjects, persists throughout our lives, and plays a role in war outside. For this reason, each individual is responsible for war in the sense of being its agent, and therefore, in an ethical universe, each individual is responsible in the sense of being accountable for abolishing it. What does it mean to take responsibility for war? Psychoanalytic literature provides many ideas about the psychic dimensions of war. In 1915, for example, during World War I, we find Freud struggling to understand the relationship between internal and external violence. expressing shock at the extreme cruelty of the war and at the participating nations' lack of respect for laws of war, a shock he later calls unjustified. Freud speculated that war depends on a regression to infantile barbarism. Regression is possible because in the development of the human mind, earlier stages persist alongside later ones. Succession involves coexistence. Normally, the capacity for barbarous deeds is held in check, even transformed, by external factors, the community and the state, which Freud speculates forbids wrongdoing, not because it desires to abolish it, but because it desires to monopolize it, like salt and tobacco. In times of war, however, the state sanctions barbarism. The most thoroughly elaborated psychoanalytic theory of war comes from an Italian analyst named Franco Fornari. Relatively unknown, Fornari was in fact president of the Italian Psychoanalytic Society, a member of Psychoanalysts Against Nuclear War, and the figure who introduced in Italy the ideas of the influential British analyst Melanie Klein. In 1964, Fornari published a book titled The Psychoanalysis of Nuclear War, following it 2 years later with The Psychoanalysis of War, the only one of his books translated into English and now out of print. It's a book that greatly influenced Vidichko. Like Freud, Fornari wants to avoid reductive approaches to the inside-outside relationship. It's not a matter of conflict between the traditionally recognized external causes of war and its unrecognized internal causes, he writes, but rather of a shift of emphasis from the former, that is, the traditionally recognized external causes, to the latter, the unrecognized internal causes. Unlike Freud, Fornari lived in the nuclear era and therefore confronted the threat of the total destruction of humanity by war. According to Fornari, war mobilizes unconscious anxieties and conflicts that, as he learned from Klein, arise from the major role played by aggression in infantile mental life. Simply put, Klein's theory goes something like this. The infant's rudimentary ego experiences conflict between loving and destructive impulses. The conflict is aroused by and experienced in relation to external objects, such as the mother's breast, which is the infant's first love object, and which stands for the principle of the outside world. The infant is terrified by its internal destructiveness, which it believes can destroy its loved love object, and rids itself of the terror by means of unconscious mechanisms of splitting and projection. Splitting the external world into good and bad objects, it projects its own destructiveness into external objects, which it then experiences as persecutory and destructive of the love object. Fornari, building on Freud's notion that early stages of mental life persist in and are available to the adult psyche, argues that the individual subject's projection of internal terror, and Fornari calls it the internal terrifier, that the individual subject's projection of internal terror onto external enemies operates in war. Only now, in adult life, the love object that needs to be protected is the nation or group. Projection, motivated by terror and love, allows us to express aggressiveness and to hate without guilt. Consequently, war provides a security system for the purpose of defending man against deep-seated anxieties about internal enemies by finding real enemies to kill. War defends us against the internal terrifier and protects
the collective love object. With the advent of the nuclear situation, however, war enters a state of crisis because nuclear war is likely to destroy the love object along with the enemy. As an important part of his theory of war, Fornari argues that the individual subject gets rid of its violence, which is prohibited by law, by investing or alienating it in the state, which, as Freud noted, monopolizes violence. In fact, Fornari says that he wants to return war to the individual subject in order to rouse individuals from the alienation in the state and cause them to take responsibility for war. In a passage that Vidichko spotlights in his book, The Abolition of War, Fornari writes, "It is we ourselves who desire war, and the alienation of our aggressiveness into the state serves us simply to be able to say that it is not we who desire war, but that the state forces us to make war. In this manner, we convince ourselves that the state is responsible for war in order not to feel responsible for it ourselves. To escape from our alienation in the state, therefore, means to be personally responsible for war, just as we feel personally responsible for inter-individual crimes. I deem it important," he continues, "to insist on the thesis that in tracing the war phenomenon to the unconscious of each man, we arrive at considering each man responsible for war." Taking responsibility for war begins, then, with taking responsibility for our responsibility for war, which is one and the same thing with taking responsibility for the unconscious. And taking for the responsibility for the unconscious means tolerating what Freud taught us, that in our unconscious, as Mignon Nixon has said, we are very bad. And tolerating our badness is the alternative to denying it, including denying it by externalizing it in the form of the enemy against whom we wage war. Tolerance, then, is central to ethico-political responsibility. Jacqueline Rose puts it like this: "It is a central tenet of psychoanalysis that if we can tolerate what is most disorienting, disillusioning about our own unconscious, we are less likely to act on it, less inclined to strike out in a desperate attempt to assign the horrors of the world to someone or somewhere else. It is not the aggressive impulse that's dangerous, but the ruthlessness of our attempts to be rid of it, to, that is, project it outward onto external enemies and go to war against them." For this reason, I disagree with Vidichko's belief, expressed in The Abolition of War, that unwar projects will eventually turn, quote, these are Vidichko's words, turn our formerly bloody, self-destructive minds into a thing of the past, making our souls war-free. This contention contradicts the principle that in reality, as Freud says, there's no such thing as eradicating psychic violence, whose disavowal rather than existence is the problem we face. Psychoanalysis, then, introduces a difficulty into the political project of war resistance and of abolishing war. Or, more accurately, psychoanalysis acknowledges the difficulty of the problem, or of the project. For psychoanalysis argues that, as Hannah Siegel, a British member of Psychoanalysts Against Nuclear War, observed, the opposition to abolishing war comes not only from others, but also has its roots in ourselves, not only from outside, but from inside as well. Well-intentioned naivete, the charge leveled at those who want to work to abolish war, lies, it now seems, not in working for a world without war, but in failing to face the difficulty of the goal, failing to recognize how hard it is to attain. Indeed, for Frenari, the only possibility of a better future rests with the difficult task of taking responsibility for the unconscious. I hope, he writes, that one day we shall be able to recognize, in the assumption of responsibility for the unconscious, first taught by Freud, the cornerstone of the edifice of a new anthropology and so of a new culture which will constitute the future receptacle of a wiser and freer humanity. He's actually quoting Thomas Mann at the end there. Put negatively, refusing responsibility for the unconscious and thereby disavowing the difficulty most likely dooms anti-war projects to failure. Let me explain what I mean by taking a little detour through a lecture delivered in the 1950s by Theodore Adorno. Titled, What Does Coming to Terms with the Past Mean?, the lecture deals with the German politics of memory and with the persistence of anti-Semitism in post-Holocaust democratic Germany, topics not unrelated to war. Adorno felt troubled by the then prevalent belief that anti-Semitism could be overcome by teaching Germans about the historical achievements of Jews, acquainting Germans with the humanity of individual Jews, or other organized acts of friendship, such as encounters between young Germans and young Israelis. Proposals like these, Adorno argued, scarcely touch upon the real difficulty of what's at stake and are therefore bound to fail. They rely too heavily on the presumption that anti-Semitism has something to do with Jews, when in reality, what makes anti-Semitism so difficult to refute is the fact that the psychic economy of countless people needs it and still seems to need it today. Individual Germans unconsciously needed anti-Semitism, just as, according to Frenari, the individual unconsciously needs war. And so Adorno, like Frenari, called for a turn to the subject, and in particular to this psychoanalytic subject. The need for an exact and undiluted knowledge of Freudian theory is as imperative as ever, he wrote. It would be therapeutic if rigorous psychoanalysis found its institutional place in and so influenced the intellectual climate of Germany. Psychoanalysis, described as a critical reflection on the self, was an essential component of Adorno's political project to overcome anti-Semitism, what Emmanuel Levinas calls that hatred of the other man. Yet today, in our time of perpetual war and sexualized torture, many intellectuals on the left act as if psychoanalysis and attention to subjectivity is a distraction from politics. By this time, you may be worried that all this talk of individual responsibility will lead me to ignore, even repudiate, the importance of collective political action. But the reverse is the case. It is precisely because we are warlike that a less warlike world requires the establishment of social institutions and, in particular, international institutions. Consider, to begin with, Immanuel Kant's 1795 pre-Freudian essay, Perpetual Peace, a Philosophical Project. Perpetual Peace proposes one of the earliest designs for an international institution, and, as Feng Shi writes, is the best-known piece of writing by any major philosopher on the topic of peace between nations. For Kant, war is human nature. Quote, A state of peace among men living together is not the same as the state of nature, which is rather a state of war. What Kant elsewhere calls radical evil, a wickedness of the heart that cannot be gotten rid of, would make peace difficult. And thus, he concludes, that is, for this very reason, quote, the state of peace must be formally instituted. Kant's reasoning applies equally if we view war psychoanalytically. Because of our ineradicable badness, of course, Freud would never use that term bad. I mean, he warns against it, but because of our ineradicable badness, unwar must be formally instituted. Fornari says as much. The purpose of the psychoanalytic disclosure of the individual responsibility for war is to prepare the ground for new social institutions which would allow the individual concretely to express his responsibility on the politico-social level. If it is I who am responsible, this is Fornari writing, it is I who must make amends. But if I must make amends, I must have concrete political instruments through which my reparative wishes may be concretely expressed. Believing that responsibility for unconscious wishes can become a social force, Fornari also advanced a proposal for the concrete political instrument he calls for in an organization named the Omega Institution. In designing the World Institute for the Abolition of War, then, Vidichko becomes an heir to a modern legacy of international peacemaking and places his project within the field of cosmopolitics. By cosmopolitics, I mean something like an international political consciousness which, though not necessarily post-nationalist, considers the well-being of people who do not live within the same geographical or cultural borders as you, and a consciousness that works against the suffering caused by capitalist cosmopolitanism, which is what Marx called exploitation on a world scale through a global mode of production. We haven't time to fully explore the similarities and differences between Vidichko's peacemaking cosmopolitics and that of his predecessors, but we can take a brief comparative look. Kant, aiming to bring about not only a cessation of hostilities, but of the threat of their breaking out, didn't propose a single all-embracing world government, but rather a federation of nations which, based on principles of international right, would establish a system of international law. Believing that the historical maturation of the human capacity for reason could counteract the warlike state of nature, Kant includes no mechanisms for enforcing the law. Fornari's Omega Institution also has lawmaking and juridical functions, but these are combined with a therapeutic one. The point of departure of the Omega Institution is twofold: acknowledgement of the unconscious motivations for war and abolition of state sovereignty, so that the state becomes subject to the same laws of individual ethics as its citizens. The abolition of sovereignty must, however, come from below. This is Fornari. When taking responsibility, individuals withdraw the violence they have invested in the state. This return to responsibility will be facilitated by the Omega Institution as establishing what can and cannot be done. It controls the individual's unconscious anxieties of guilt and defends him against the internal terrifier, as war once did. Vidichko no doubt supports international law and embraces the Enlightenment demand for universal freedom and justice, but the World Institute, which, like the Omega Institution, is grounded in a psychoanalytic view of war, is not anchored in the model of the nation state, as our classical paradigms of international law and as our Hans and Fornari's institutions. Rather, the World Institute stresses multilateral alliances, such as the Discursive Forum for the Abolition of War and the Cross-Disciplinary Center for Global Peace Projects, which are going to be on the top floor. Vidichko's proposal, then, constructs a new cosmopolitics, one in keeping with Jacques Derrida's assertion that if we want to cultivate the spirit of the cosmopolitan tradition, we must also try to adjust the limits of this tradition to our own time. Our time includes the unification of Europe and the existence of a mass population of refugees with no political identities. Under these conditions, says Derrida, we must recognize that justice and democracy are not fully exercised within the framework of the nation state or the boundaries of the law, as these do not ensure hospitality to strangers, which for Derrida is ethics. World Institute is neither a lawmaking nor a governing organization, but rather a public one, not just because it is open to a pre-existing public, but because it produces a public by encouraging, and here it does participate in the Kantian tradition, by encouraging the exercise of critical speech, which, when it takes the form of agonistic discourse, may itself be an alternative to war. Kant wrote Perpetual Peace shortly after he was reprimanded by King Frederick Wilhelm II for misleading the youth and showing disrespect for the Christian religion and the Holy Scriptures. Kant promised not to lecture or write on religious topics and kept his promise until the king died in 1797. The Kant scholar Alan Wood reads Perpetual Peace as Kant's assertion that he had no intention of keeping silent on other matters of general public concern. Perhaps this explains the preface to the essay, wherein Kant remarks upon the practical politician's condescending attitude to theorists. The worldly wise statesman believes that the theorist is a mere academic who cannot endanger the state. It thus follows, writes Kant, that if the practical politician is to be consistent, he must not claim, in the event of a dispute with the theorist, to scent any danger to the state in the opinions which the theorist has randomly uttered in public. By this saving clause, the author of this essay, Kant, will consider himself expressly safeguarded in correct and proper style against all malicious interpretation. Kant casts himself as an idealistic philosopher, far removed from practical affairs, trading in illusions. The role that, as I said at the beginning of my talk, is frequently assigned to those who take up the project of abolishing war. Kant's preface is ironic, however, because, as Wood says, Kant actually rejects the notion that historical hopes must never be entertained, as though we could not devote ourselves to final ends of humanity unless we see clear signs that humanity is on the brink of fulfilling them. World Institute for the Abolition of War makes clear that the same is true of Vidichko. In a time of perpetual war, Vidichko gives form to a historical hope, the hope of unwar, allowing it to appear and thereby producing a public space. Thank you.
Hi, thanks very much. The a question about your reading and the artist's reading of this project, and that is, I was thinking of the Arc de la Défense, which is this, which is online with Arc de Triomphe, is a giant modernist box put over the form of the Arc de Triomphe, would seem to be a case of the kind of veiling of the bad. I can, since all the iconography you've mentioned is completely not repeated in that, and also stands as the great monument for that neighborhood of late 20th century global capitalism. And I'm wondering, so I'm wondering if the resonance to Vodichka's project is simply superficial, or whether he's thinking through a kind of deconstructing of that of project in a kind of deep way of the Arc de la Défense.
That's a great question. I hadn't really thought of it at all, and I haven't really talked to Vodichko about this project yet. But it would seem to me that Vodichko's project could be playing off of the Défense project. But in the same way that he uses unwar rather than peace, contrasting with it in the same way that his term contrasts with peace, that peace is really much too simple a term. It does suggest that war can produce peace. You know, it's not really treating the war memorial as a pathological symptom in the same way.
And if I remember, too, there is in some upstairs weird set of spaces in the Arc de la Défense, there is a museum of the making of Europe after World War II, if I remember correctly. So that it seemed
to be. Well, you're giving me really great ideas for expanding this. Thank you.
Thank you. Thucydides, the ancient Greek father of history, in his classic study of the Peloponnesian Wars, wrote that the three basic causes of war are greed, fear, and fanaticism. I don't think very much has changed in the intervening years. Now, it seems to me that the psychoanalytical theories that you're talking about explain how these operate both for individuals and for society, whether they be conscious or unconscious. The question is how these are being addressed. And it seems to me, no matter how much we understand the wiring, in effect, unless we do something about the motives, we're not going to get any further ahead. So what does your artist that you're using, Vodichko, suggest as ways of eliminating greed, fear, and fanaticism? Because otherwise, no matter whatever you do in terms of world institutes or in terms of iconography or whatever you call it, you're still stuck with these problems of greed, fear, and fanaticism. How do we eliminate or lessen their effect on human behavior?
Well, I sort of thought that was what my entire talk was about, actually. But, you know, as I said, quoting Jacqueline Rose and Freud, if we're talking greed, fear, and fanaticism and bringing them into aggressiveness as the unconscious motivator, or one of them, this is only one of the motivators, but let's say one of the motivators for war, then the psychoanalytic project would be, as Adorno said, to make psychoanalysis part of the intellectual climate in order to not eradicate those things, because they're ineradicable. According to psychoanalytic theory, they're not eradicable. You cannot get rid of them. Just as, you know, Kant, who didn't have psychoanalysis at his disposal, said that radical evil cannot be gotten rid of. What I'm arguing for is the importance of acknowledging that. That's what I'm calling taking responsibility for the unconscious in order not to act on it. So as Jacqueline Rose said, it's not the impulse that's the problem or dangerous. It's the attempt to get rid of the impulse by projecting it onto other people. That's just one suggestion. I don't have an answer to how to get rid of war.
I'm suggesting something that is a contribution to that project. You're welcome.
I was wondering, I don't know the actual details of the different platforms that he's proposing, mm-hmm. and I mean, the structure just seems fascinating. It seems to me that it seems to be a structure which will allow for many people to circulate. It seems that you'll have places where you can perhaps sit and deliberate. I don't know, or if it's just looking at things.
But all of those.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
And so I thought that was really interesting because in a way, if we're going to, I mean, I had as a reference, but maybe it's not really there, even Tatlin's Tower, in mm-hmm. a way. Mm. I don't know if any of these...
As a new kind of monument.
Yeah, as a new kind of monument. Mm-hmm. And a monument also with different layers and different mm-hmm. platforms. But that's it also, what I find interesting in the structure, because if we're going to think about subjectivity, if we're going to think of how, in fact, the unwar, because unwar suggests a process, right?
Exactly.
You're unwarring. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that as you go from one place to the other and you deliberate and there's a debate and you look and you interact, mm-hmm. that in fact he's sort of introducing us into the possibility of looking at things from different perspectives, mm-hmm. different platforms, mm-hmm. if he's also not allowing for a certain movement of the spectator, which will be conceived as a process, right?
Yes.
And that, in fact, the unwarring is unfolding that way.
Yes.
Is that how the structure...
I think that's a very beautiful analysis, mm. and that, you know, I think this is a work that is very much about... of course, it's about peacemaking, which is also a process, but it's also related to advancing or thinking about democracy.
So perhaps one last question, because we need to have a break.
There's someone over here who's had her hand up.
I just wanted to add to the other comment, which I really appreciated as a succinct analysis, is any project to combat war will also be a project to combat dehumanization. And I think that there are many forces in the world that do that. They're also, I hope it isn't just, you know, nice aesthetics and a beautiful agora, but also something more concrete that alters the way we think. And I think you were talking about that, combating dehumanization and cruelty.
Mm-hmm.